Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 26, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on foreign intelligence collection. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome two experts as well as a moderator, Matthew Hyman. I'll turn things over to him now to introduce our topic and to make more complete introductions of our speakers. Matthew, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Will, and thanks to all that have joined us, including our two speakers. In alphabetical order, I'll start with Matt Olson, who today is the president of IronNet Cybersecurity, a consultancy firm. Prior to joining IronNet, Matt had a long and distinguished career with the federal government. Most recently, Matt was the director of the National Counterterrorism Center from 2011 to 2014. Prior to joining NICTIC, Matt was also the general counsel for the National Security Agency. And prior to that, he held a number of roles within the Department of Justice related to national security and intelligence matters, as well as law enforcement matters. So we welcome Matt. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thank you.
Our second speaker today also has had a long and distinguished career in national security and intelligence matters. His name is David Shedd. And today, David is the Distinguished Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and he's also an adjunct professor at Patrick Henry College. Prior to his service at Heritage and Patrick Henry, David was the acting director for the Defense Intelligence Agency, and that was following 4 years service as the deputy director for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And up until January 2015, he led the Defense Intelligence Enterprise workforce, which was made up of about almost 17,000 military and civilian employees. Prior to DIA, David was the deputy director for policy plans and requirements at the Director of National Intelligence. That was from 2007 to 2010. Before that, David was the chief of staff and later the acting director of intelligence staff at the DNI. And then prior to that, David served in various roles at the National Security Council, as well as at the Central Intelligence Agency. So, David, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely delighted to be here.
So, as you can see, we have two deeply experienced experts in the area of national security and intelligence. Matt, obviously a lawyer. David, a consumer and operator of intelligence, so I think it'll be a good balanced discussion. And the topic we want to focus on today is electronic surveillance as it's conducted under Executive Order 12333. And just by way of background for the audience, Executive Order 12333 was signed by President Reagan in 1981, and it organized a number of responsibilities within the intelligence community. Included among those was responsibility for electronic surveillance. And electronic surveillance happens under the rubric of 12333. It's happened since 1981, and it continues today. That being said, there have been some alterations along the way to 12333 in terms of how that electronic surveillance is collected and used. And probably the most noteworthy change of recent vintage was President Obama's Presidential Policy Directive 28, so sometimes called PPD 28. That came out in January 2014, and it made some alterations to the way 12333, the way operations happen under 12333, and we'll get into those in a minute. But I want to begin with sort of a ground-setting question, and this question goes to you, Matt. I know there's been significant press in the wake of the Snowden revelations about FISA surveillance, and we hear a lot about what was Section 215, and sometimes we hear about 702. I think probably there may not be as keen an understanding of what 12333 surveillance is, and I was wondering if maybe you could talk about how does 12333 surveillance differ from what we think of when we talk about FISA surveillance?
Sure thing, Matt. So it's a really important place to start in thinking about the range of issues that we are talking about when it comes to the conduct of foreign intelligence collection and specifically electronic surveillance in pursuit of foreign intelligence. And so the term 12333 surveillance is used quite often. It is how people sometimes think about surveillance outside of FISA, but it is itself actually a bit of a misnomer to talk about 12333 surveillance. I say that because the executive order that you described, going back to President Reagan, which has been updated as recently as 2008, 12333 itself is not a source of authority. It is rather, the executive order really is a foundational executive branch document for how the intelligence community is organized and how it should conduct its activities. Certainly, 12333 imposes structure on the IC. It provides direction to agencies to make sure that their activities support policymakers who are responsible for national security. But if you look at the executive order, you'll find no place where it actually itself authorizes the specific collection of electronic surveillance or conduct of electronic surveillance, for example. What 12333 does do is operate against the backdrop of the authority granted to the president and to the intelligence community under the Constitution and under federal law, in particular under Article 2 of the Constitution and the National Security Act. So to get to your question, when we say 12333 surveillance, what we are really talking about in current sort of parlance is foreign intelligence collection outside of FISA. So there, you can think about the general conduct of electronic surveillance typically would be simply regulated under 12333 unless it meets the definitions that would subject that activity to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is in some ways a subset of the broader Article 2 authority that the president has to conduct foreign affairs and to collect intelligence as part of his Article 2 authorities and responsibilities. So just a word on FISA to make sure that just sort of level setting question that you put forward, Matt, you know, FISA itself was passed in 1978. It is principally a statute designed to regulate the collection of foreign intelligence inside the United States. Obviously, FISA established a special court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It set forward the procedures and standards for obtaining a court order that would authorize foreign intelligence collection, again, inside the United States. It was passed largely in reaction to the abuses identified in the Church Committee report. But it is, like I've said, against the backdrop of the broader authority of the president. It regulates that authority when it comes to collecting foreign intelligence in the United States. Executive Order 12333 is the foundational document that sort of organizes the intelligence community to carry out all the rest of those activities that aren't otherwise subject to statute, such as FISA. So it's best to think about 12333 not as itself a source of authority, but as an executive order that regulates how the and sets roles and responsibilities for the intelligence community, and is itself a reflection or manifestation of the president's Article 2 authority to conduct electronic surveillance in support of his responsibilities to protect the country. So hopefully that's somewhat helpful, but I do think it's important at the very outset just to make clear, even though we talk about 12333 authority, it doesn't really itself authorize electronic surveillance as much as sort of set forward the roles and responsibilities that agencies have for carrying out certain types of activities in support of the president's Article 2 authority.
Got it. No, that's very helpful. So if we then turn to the sort of the consumer or operational side of intelligence, and that's the part of the field you worked for most of your career, David, when you think about the foreign intelligence or the electronic surveillance that is derived outside of the FISA context, can you just talk about how that surveillance is used by the intelligence community and the value that it provides to the intelligence community?
That's a great follow-on to Matt's foundational explanation in terms of the relationship of EO-12333 and the authorities associated with derived from the president in Article 2 on electronic surveillance, to then really describe what in my experience was the value proposition from that. Before doing that, I would simply highlight that to Matt's point about the organizational construct in captured in EO-12333, in its update of July 2008, it was very intentional after the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004 that in updating EO-12333, and the number was kept because in many ways it was so highly recognized as the foundational executive order for the functions and responsibilities of the intelligence community elements, that everyone would still recognize it as that foundational piece. But therein, the authorities and the role and responsibilities of the Director of National Intelligence were captured, and precisely to the topic of this conversation, the SecDef, the Secretary of Defense, was then called upon to coordinate with the Director of National Intelligence in executing under the Secretary of Defense delegated authorities the activities pertaining to signals intelligence or electronic surveillance. And this applies to the foreign piece and capturing that electronic surveillance for our own national security interests. So with that caveat, to underscore what Matt was saying, it gave direction on the organizational aspects and the relationship then of this newly established, back in 2004, Director of National Intelligence, and under the leadership of Mike McConnell as DNI at the time, in what was about an 18-month process, a number of us helped lead us to an updated EO-12333, which actually also addressed organizationally, again, the responsibilities of the DNI in relationship to the SecDef and the authorities delegated to him or her over the signals intelligence. So now more directly to your question, I break it down in three areas in terms of the value in terms of what the operator gets from it. Probably at the highest level, what we have is essentially for the better part of, and really going back to World War II, but certainly post that in the National Security Act of 1947, the ability of our nation to collect foreign intelligence through electronic surveillance has turned out to be, and this is my word here, the mainstay by way of capabilities in support of indications and warning, and all the way through to the penetrations of understanding plans and intentions of our adversaries. And in doing so, in the last 15 years, this has become even more accentuated in terms of support to the warfighter in Iraq and Afghanistan, the efforts, and Matt can certainly give chapter and verse examples of the efforts on counterterrorism, and as a former human to Earth, someone that focused on human intelligence, it pains me to say that in fact signals intelligence was and will always be, in my opinion, the mainstay or the principal focus of our national security intelligence apparatus. So that's and that goes and it transcends from the warfighter all the way through to senior policymakers in terms of the understanding of plans and intentions of our adversaries. Secondly, is not unusual that that collected foreign information discovers new connections that were otherwise not evident without that collection. In other words, as you look at, for example, organized crime, you oftentimes are led down the path through that electronic surveillance, all in the foreign context, to identify then elements of governments, political establishments, political party members, and that who may very well be part of that organized crime network, whether explicitly or implicitly, and it provides then to the user of the electronic surveillance visibility into activities that you otherwise would not have detected were you not able to collect that. Thirdly, then, sort of the concern that I have is that, and Matthew, you mentioned the President's Policy Directive 28 that just is a little over 2 years old in further restricting the collection or electronic collection, again, in the foreign arena, is that it now has sort of a human in the loop in a more directive way in deciding what constitutes a national security threat that oftentimes, or at times, I should say, is not always evident, as I just gave in the example of the organized crime example, and where absent that direction under PPD 28, the National Security Agency would not be permitted to collect that. And that concerns me a great deal because, again, in the old Rumsfeldian description of unknown unknowns, you often don't know the connections before you have the collection on a certain priority. And if that's not provided in terms of the users of that information, you in fact cut off, I believe, as an operator, opportunities to better understand the connections that are associated with the original collection that you would have had, but otherwise is not approved because of the PPD 28 process. Now, good people can disagree on the value of a greater hands-on direct intervention by policymakers in the White House and so forth on that kind of collection. My personal view is that the operator is much better served by the president having delegated that authority for making those decisions, and in the case of an exemption of doing so by way of collection, is better off with people that. I'll use the male pronoun, that he trusts as the president to come to him and say, I have concerns about this particular type of collection because of political and policy sensitivities. Perhaps we'd better stand down on it, but we're standing down, notwithstanding having the opportunity and possibilities of being able to collect them. That's perfectly fine. But to have an entire apparatus now that does multiple reviews of this, and the collector, NSA in this case, has to await that direction, I think is really cuts back the opportunities that I think we need for our own national security.
And just to follow on that point, David, I know one of the things that PPD 28 says is that in the context of bulk collection, it can only be for, and I think there are six categories, you know, espionage, terrorism, I think proliferation of weapons, cyber war, threats to U.S. or allied troops, and transnational crime. So is that an example in your mind of where maybe you're applying the filter too soon because something may not fit or look like one of those categories? We're missing out on something that may be of value later to addressing those topics or something else?
Exactly. I think that by trying to bin them in such a precise way, you may be potentially in the case of bulk data collection, again, cutting out opportunities that are then through various algorithms get you to connecting the proverbial dots or data that you're looking for to point you by way of indications and warning that transcends those six categories. It's difficult for me to understand why that kind of limitation would be placed on it as an a priori PPD 28 and then annually reviewed by the president. Why not delegate that down to, again, the DHRNZA and have an internal process overseen by the DNI to actually see, and again, it would be incumbent then on the director of NSA, the DNI, to alert the policymaker community about the risk associated with a bulk data collection that's outside of those six areas of activity, which you have to know a priori are six areas of activity that sometimes in the real world are not exactly clear.
Right. Matt, just turning back to you, sometimes critics of electronic surveillance, and rather than calling it 12333 surveillance, because I take your point that that's not really the right terminology to use for it, but let's say non-FISA regulated surveillance. Critics have said, well, this is unregulated. There's not effective controls over it. I know the Presidential Civil Liberties Oversight Board is currently doing a review of this of collection that relates to this the kind of the non-FISA electronic surveillance, and some people have opined that, well, maybe we should apply some sort of a FISA mechanism to non-FISA collection. And I'm just wondering from your perspective, firstly, is it unregulated? And then I'll ask you, and then I'll ask David, what would it mean if you tried to apply a FISA-like framework to the not what is today non-FISA collection?
Right. So it's another really good question. Certainly, just to go right to the bottom line, certainly FISA represents a degree of regulation over surveillance activities that goes beyond what 12333 has, right? Requiring a court order, having a special court to review applications from the government. There's nothing similar in terms of regulation for activities undertaken as under 12333. But the confusion is that, or the misnomer, again, misconception is that there's no regulation of 12333. And so let me just take a minute to talk about how activities undertaken under the executive order are in fact restricted or regulated. In fact, the executive order imposes a number of significant restrictions on, generally speaking, I'll start more generally, then I'll kind of narrow it down to particular, electronic surveillance. But generally speaking, it imposes significant restrictions on operational activities. And, these restrictions aren't typically mandated by statute or constitution, but they do give force to the language in the first section, the very beginning of the executive order, which states that the U.S. government has a solemn obligation to, quote, protect freedom, civil liberties, and privacy rights of U.S. persons. So let me identify a few of the restrictions on activities under 12333. One is that intelligence agencies must use the least intrusive collection techniques feasible within the United States or against U.S. persons who are overseas. That's one. Two, that, again, this goes to the how agencies are assigned responsibilities. The FBI is the only intelligence element which is authorized to conduct physical searches inside the United States. The CIA is generally prohibited from engaging in any electronic surveillance within the United States. Intelligence agencies are not permitted under the executive order to conduct intrusive investigative techniques such as electronic surveillance inside the United States unless they follow those procedures that are approved by the Attorney General. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And then other important restrictions include the prohibition on intelligence agencies participating indirectly in any forbidden activities, and then, of course, the prohibition on assassination. So going a little more specifically to, I mentioned the procedures approved by the Attorney General, because from the perspective of protecting civil liberties, there's a critical provision of the executive order which mandates that intelligence agencies may only collect, retain, or disseminate information concerning United States persons in accordance with procedures that the Attorney General has approved. And we often talk about these rules for folks who are familiar and have practiced in this area. We often talk about AG guidelines or Attorney General guidelines or minimization procedures. These are widely recognized as the basic requirements within the intelligence community for handling information about U.S. persons. So any surveillance undertaken outside of FISA, again, under EO 12333, would be subject to these Attorney General guidelines. And I'll use NSA as the example most, because I'm most familiar with NSA. It operates under the executive order in accordance with AG-approved procedures, which are set forth in a directive called U.S. Signals Intelligence Directive 18. And this directive was updated in 2011. It was released publicly in 2013 with some redactions. And it's sort of the essential reference for NSA personnel. My experience as being the general counsel at NSA, everyone had a copy who dealt with any U.S. could touch U.S. person information. Everybody knew these procedures. They were trained on it. They were tested on it. They understood that USID 18 was sort of the critical manual and set of requirements for handling U.S. person information. So let me just take a quick minute to talk about how that regulated surveillance undertaken under the executive order. One of the key provisions was that NSA could not use a U.S. person as a selection term, such as a name or a phone number or an email address of a U.S. person to search databases containing information that had been collected under 12333. Now, the exception to this was that this prohibition was that NSA could conduct such a search if and only if the Attorney General had made a probable cause finding that the U.S. person was an agent of a foreign power. So that starts to look a little bit more like FISA. So you can't look at this data unless the Attorney General has found a probable cause that the person you're searching for is an agent of a foreign power. Another key restriction is that the agency couldn't identify a U.S. person in a disseminated report, an intelligence report, unless the identity of that U.S. person was necessary to understand the foreign intelligence in the report. So you had to assert that this was necessary to understand the foreign intelligence before you could identify a U.S. person. And then generally, NSA was only allowed to retain information about U.S. persons for no more than 5 years. So these are the restrictions that are built into the executive order for electronic surveillance conducted outside of FISA that sort of start to look more and more like FISA in terms of the protections they afford to U.S. person privacy. And then the last point I'll make, turn it back over to you, is just that NSA's compliance with these rules, these U.S. person rules, is subject to extensive oversight both within the executive branch, across the executive branch, and then also through the intelligence committees in Congress, which generally oversee NSA's activities.
So with all that, Matt, so it doesn't sound like, I mean, let me back up. It sounds like the Department of Justice, when it comes to U.S. person information, is playing a pretty central role in policing how the selector is used and then ultimately how it might be disseminated to other elements of the IC. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's all designed by the terms of the executive order, which requires this, designed to afford privacy and civil liberties protections to U.S. persons. So while NSA overseas may collect data in pursuit of its foreign intelligence mission, searching for a U.S. person identifier or disseminating information about a U.S. person is highly restricted and regulated by the executive branch and overseen by Congress, and in particular by the Department of Justice and NSA itself.
So let me pose the question to perhaps you and David, which is, what would it mean as a practical matter if someone said, okay, that's fine, Mr. Olson, we've heard you explain how the executive branch regulates all this, but why not just apply the FISA court rubric? Why not have the court involved in policing all this? What would be the, how would that either compromise or hinder or change the dynamic for you know, the folks that are trying to collect this and the intelligence, and then the folks that are trying to understand what the collection means. And so, you know, maybe Matt, you could talk to it from a process point of view, and then David, if you could maybe speak to it just from an operational logistics point of view.
Well, it's almost hard to overstate the consequences of that approach. I mean, it would be a sea change in how we've, as a country, have approached the collection of foreign intelligence, which has really been the foundational idea, has been to largely to distinguish between U.S. citizens who are entitled to the protections of the Fourth Amendment on one hand, and non-U.S. persons outside of the United States who are not entitled to those protections under the Constitution. So the executive order gives life to the Fourth Amendment protections that U.S. citizens are entitled to, while allowing NSA to have the ability to, and along with other intelligence agencies, to conduct the to collect information that has been deemed necessary to protect the country. To apply a regime for the intelligence community operating outside the United States and collecting information about non-U.S. persons in the same way that we apply that to U.S. persons, I think would be, well, first of all, it would be, from a process point of view, it would be, as I said, a enormously consequential and a significant divergence from our past practice. But I suspect David would echo this. From my perspective, as a consumer of this information when I was at NCTC, would, I think, undermine our ability to collect the types of information that are necessary, at least from a counterterrorism perspective, to protect the country.
David,
let me pile on.
Yeah,
sure. Let me pile on to what Matt has said, starting with his last point in his experience at NCTC, because it serves as a good example and quasi symbolically of the challenges that you would have if you applied FISA-like rules to the foreign intelligence collection related to electronic surveillance. I divide it in two parts. One is agility, and the other part is scope or size and the amount of. And I think by inference to what Matt was saying when he says the sea change, applying that to what has been, going back to my original word in describing in your first question directed at me, Matthew, the magnitude piece of this as a mainstay in foreign intelligence collection cannot be overstated. Then to apply that process-wise to any suggestion of a FISA-like court approach to that would strike me as, in the first instance, extraordinarily difficult by way of ensuring that you have the agility to move against targets that are a clear and present danger as well as strategic danger and all of that, often not knowing where your collection is going to lead you, as I already said. And then secondly, the size of it. I mean, I guess as a very practical matter, I'm not getting over the ability to think about what the bureaucracy would look like in order to apply what rightfully is applied to U.S. person collection to the vast trove of foreign collection. And so it's affecting both agility and the scope of it would give me grave concern. And maybe others on this call, as we open it up, have a better way of trying to figure that out. But I certainly can't get there from a standpoint of what I know from my career without getting into specifics, what the implications of that would be.
Well, and let me – I'm sorry, Matt, did you have another comment?
Yeah, if I could just – do a quick add-on to that. I agree completely with David here, and just a bit of, and you know this, Matthew, having worked in the Department of Justice, National Security Division, working on FISA, but if you just think about an individual FISA application to a judge on the FISA court to seek authorization for collection against a U.S. person, so against somebody here in the U.S. Who is allegedly an agent of foreign power, those applications took typically weeks to compile. They could be 50 pages long. They involved presentations to judges about why the target was an agent of foreign power, all to meet the very strict requirements of FISA, which are, you know, largely driven by Fourth Amendment concerns. It's impossible to imagine that type of a regulatory process, bureaucratic process, legal process being applied to the collection of a person in Yemen who's not a U.S. citizen, and, you know, that where the collection is going to take place in Yemen. You know, it's obviously just, it defies logic to imagine how you would do that, why you would do that, what court do you go to get a, to get approval for that collection. So these kinds of, this sort of reflexive call for FISA type protections for non-U.S. citizens overseas really doesn't add up from my perspective.
Yeah, no.
And Matthew, if I can now just pile on to what Matt said. I mean, the other thing that it would do is dramatically shift that decision-making into a legal process rather than a policy one. And to me, that would also be yet another difficulty that I can't quite get over the hump of trying to think about how in that process the legal application for that FISA equivalent on that foreign collection target is of any added value when you're talking about policy objectives that are requiring that kind of collection, if you follow me. So just in what Matt was saying, I came up with one additional piece, which is the shift that would have to take place from essentially a policy-driven structure of review of that collection carried out through a DNI and all that, one to over to a legal one.
Right. Well, and the last question I'll ask the two of you to give thought to before we open it up to the callers is, you both touched on this, which is applying the FISA rubric to the 12333 type collection would in many ways diminish the differentiation that's traditionally been made by both operators and national security lawyers between U.S. persons and non-U.S. persons. And in my reading of PPD 28, it seems to be that President Obama has moved us slightly in that direction, in the sense that it does diminish the distinction. Or in other words, certain intelligence we're now collecting, whether it's about foreign persons or U.S. persons, is to receive consistent treatment. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that, and maybe if you could talk about the obvious legal distinction that's always been made between U.S. persons and non-U.S. persons, and why, and then the operational distinctions that have been made over the years, and maybe why that's been.
So I'll just jump in quickly,
yeah.
if that's all right. And just on the legal distinction, I touched on this before, which is to say that, you know, the as a general proposition, and it's actually well established that non-U.S. persons who don't have sufficient connection with the United States, particularly those who are not in the United States, are not entitled to the protections of the Fourth Amendment. And so essentially the Supreme Court's held that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to non-U.S. persons overseas. And that's been a, you know, a foundational doctrine for how we construct our foreign intelligence collection activities. So PPD 28 has started down the path of looking at the potential, you know, for safeguarding, you know, all persons' information that was collected through signals intelligence. I think there is an important question that needs to be watched carefully to see if those sort of aspirational protections begin to constrain intelligence collection. In other words, treating non-U.S. persons like U.S. persons, because it's a little bit vague in how much what sort of teeth the directive PPD 28 will have. So I just think it's an area that bears close scrutiny going forward.
From an operational standpoint, the idea of language contained in PPD 28 that in essence is calls upon the treatment of all persons with dignity and respect, and a recognition that all persons, sort of thinking of a global citizen here, have the legitimate privacy interests, is a step in that direction that Matt was describing toward a U.S. person-like treatment. I think the most deleterious impact of that is that it can have the effect on the collector to become more risk averse. That is, fearing that they are coming to the line or, God forbid, crossing that line in collection where the PPD 28 direction is being either violated or it's in a gray area, they all stand down on the collection. And the example that I gave on a predicate related to organized crime, but that takes them into, you know, collection on a political figure, and that again, the senior leadership of the IC gets paid in part to have the judgment to know what are the warning signs from a policy political standpoint by way of risk management as to what that is, as opposed to a legal matter. And so I'm concerned that PPD 28 to an operator means it ultimately, that operator gets less and better intelligence in real time because of a process that goes down, not entirely at, but down the pathway of U.S. person collection types of rules by way of the language that I gave you. And that's very real. Very real.
Well, I thank you both. I think we've got about 15 minutes left for some Q&A, and I suspect there may be some questions on the line. Will, do we have anyone that wants to ask a question?
Thanks, Matthew. We'll open the floor for questions now and let people begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. Okay, again, to request the floor, if you have a question, please enter star and then the pound key. While we wait for people to queue up, I want to make a really quick programming announcement. Our next Teleform call is going to be on Monday at 2 p.m. We're going to preview oral arguments in the Texas abortion case before the Supreme Court. So we hope that you'll join us then. We do have a question on the line now. We'll go to that questioner. If you want to be second in line here, please do hit star and then the pound key. Let's go to our first question.
Thank you very much for the engaging discussion this afternoon. I'm Gordon Middleton from Patrick Henry College. I'm curious as to how you react, particularly on where we ended up in the conversation. I think there was reference made to this notion of a global citizen, et cetera. It seems to me that this whole notion is striking at the very foundation, or at least at the foundational idea of national identity, and seems to be a step toward, I would assert, attacking the very idea of national security. I'm interested in how you react to that.
Who wants to tackle that, Matt or David?
Just very quickly, Gordon, thank you for the comment and then the question associated with that. That's why I am sufficiently concerned about PPD 28 to have written about it, in that it's, in my view, a step in the direction of really thinking of the foreign national in which who is not protected under the Fourth Amendment is somehow requiring a special dispensation from a legal process on collecting on that person, entity, or target. And that to me is a slippery slope, because at some point you're going to find yourself with less collection and less clarity for the collector in where those bright lines that have been the traditional bright lines between foreign and U.S. person, not to call it domestic, but U.S. person, no matter where that is in the world, is drawn. And so it really starts to chip away at that clear divide. So I'll turn it over to Matt there, and that's kind of my view on it.
So, and I think I'm with David here. I appreciate your question as well, Gordon. And the concern, I think, is the one that David raised in terms of how the impact of the overall tone of PPD 28 on the intelligence community, and whether it creates a degree of risk averseness that would undermine our ability to be effective, because the executive order or the presidential order itself, PPD 28, really talks in terms of treating non-U.S. persons and U.S. persons similarly, to the extent that that can be done consistent with national security. So it, on its terms, it sort of carves out the importance of national security, but it does take a step that hadn't been taken before in terms of treating all people, regardless of what their nationality, similarly for the purposes of signals intelligence. And again, that's why I say we ought to be very careful in watching how this plays out going forward.
And I'm just curious, I'd put this to both of you. Are you aware of, to the extent that other countries engage in electronic surveillance, are you aware of any other country that takes that policy position in terms of trying to treat non-citizens in a way that it would be consistent with the treatment of citizens?
So, Matthew, I do not know. So I don't know what, for example, European countries, how they handle this. My strong suspicion, from what I do know in my interaction with the intelligence services in Europe, is that they, similar to the U.S., draw a very clear distinction between their citizens and non-citizens.
Yeah.
And I would say similar is what we do. But I would also, this I'm more confident about, and that is that no country that I'm aware of has the degree of oversight generally of their intelligence activities as the United States. So no country, for example, has a system of checks and balances like a FISA court and congressional intelligence committees that have the sort of authority and practice of regulating intelligence activities to the degree we do here in the United States. That I'm confident of.
Yeah.
And I would add to what Matt just said on the final point, a lot of them were and remain concerned that kind of oversight will actually come into their own system, and they weren't exactly welcoming of it. I will say that I know, and I welcome any correction on this, I know of no country post-PPD 28 that has reciprocated publicly with an agreement of the sort of what's contained in PPD 28, which goes to the whole point of the openness and transparency of our system, many parts of which I not only embrace, but I think it speaks to our values. But the fact is that no other country that I know of post PPD 28 has done a reciprocal agreement on the kind of process that's included in that document, that presidential directive.
Well, thank you both. Will, do we have any other questions on the line?
We do not. If you want to be our next questioner and you hit star and the pound key, we'll put you on immediately. Matthew, I'll let you know if anyone jumps on. Please hit star and the pound key if you'd like to join us. Until then, though, we might want to continue the conversation while we wait.
Sure. I may have one last question for our two panelists, and that is, it's kind of a looking over the horizon question, which is, we've got a live debate that seems to be developing around non-FISA surveillance in addition to the ongoing debate that relates to FISA surveillance itself. I'm just wondering, as two former participants in the intelligence community and national security, is there something different we should be thinking about in terms of how we talk about these topics with the public, how we express the value that you both recognize in electronic surveillance while also giving people the assurance, as you've articulated on this call, that you know, whether it's FISA-related surveillance or 12333 surveillance, that you know, there's not sort of you know, electronic surveillance run amok, and that you know, there are you know, very significant regulatory processes that apply to all the flavors of electronic surveillance. Is there something our policymakers should be doing different? Is there something that members of the intelligence community could be doing different? Recognizing, of course, that a lot of what they do you can't talk about explicitly in public. But I'm wondering if you have thoughts about how do we better inform the public so that, you know, the intelligence community can, you know, enjoy the support it needs to go forward and provide the protection that the public needs.
Well, let me just jump in on that excellent question. And it's one topic that I've often thought about, how valuable it is when it does occur, but at the same time, relatively rare when it does, where customers, without getting into sources and methods, praise the impact of the collection. In other words, those who are prepared to speak up as third parties to the intelligence community, in my view, are far more valuable than former intelligence community or current members of the IC sort of tooting what appears to be tooting their own horn on the value of this type of collection. So in other words, every time I could get a four-star privately telling me out of a combatant command what difference a particular collection information that they had in their hands had made to a decision that they'd made or to their J5 and their planning and their J3 operational side, one, I encourage them to pass that along on the Hill as our elected representatives who could then speak up on it to the degree that they're not revealing classified information. And secondly, when possible, speak to it publicly. What difference that intelligence generically had made in their better decision-making, better options, and better understanding of the nature of the adversaries that they were either planning against or acting against, and sometimes a bit of both. And that, to me, would be extraordinarily valuable. And that, but it's, in the big scheme of things, relatively rare. Apart from, of course, intelligence professionals talking about the value of intelligence.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that, Matt, in terms of...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd pick up right on David's point, and it's sort of a similar thought, and one that has been, I think, you know, increasingly apparent to us following the Snowden leaks. I mean, the public debate following the disclosures by Snowden have focused, you know, almost exclusively on the privacy and civil liberties impacts of the collection activities that were revealed, and you know, a lot of that really centered on the NSA telephone metadata program, which is really just a very, very small part of the overall collection enterprise, of course, for the intelligence community. But what needs to happen, I think, to really put all of the information on the table so that the country can strike the right balance is what David mentioned, which is the value of the collection. How has it helped the warfighter? How has it helped policymakers make good judgments on the range of challenges we face? And then I think the other element that needs to be part of that discussion in order, to strike the right balance is the threat. And we can do a better job in government and outside government talking about the persistent and varied threats the country faces around the world and here in the United States. So all that should be part of the dialogue, and too much of it has really focused just on the privacy impacts of our collection.
Well, thank you for that. Will, any other questions on the line?
We don't have anything else on the line. I think we can make brief closing statements here.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts or comments from David or Matt?
David, I'll just quickly say, first, thank you to the Federalist Society and Matthew and your team for pulling this together. I think it's very useful. I do think, looking ahead, that we need to be thinking about these issues as we face additional discussion about whether it's restrictions or on the intelligence community or for further protections for non-U.S. persons. These are vital issues that discussions like this can help inform.
Yeah, and let me just echo Matt's thanks to the Federalist Society for arranging this. I think this is a very, very important topic, and I it's long from over, as 702 in another year and a half will be in the full debate mode, and where the Privacy and Civil Liberties Board may or may not come out on this in terms of what you said, Matthew, at the start. Means that at a minimum, there's going to be public debate about the issue of the foreign versus U.S. person electronic surveillance issue. And secondly, just to remind everyone, and I remind myself, is that we're a country that I'm very proud that we're a country of law and order. And the social contract with the American people is absolutely vital to effective collection. That is, in the aftermath of Snowden, the focus, as Matt's already mentioned, turned it into really largely a civil liberties privacy issue, while at the same time really taking away from the enormous value associated with the kind of collection that that for so many years, decades, the National Security Agency in particular has provided to the safety and security of the American people. So I think that whole debate is a healthy debate to have, but at the same time, getting advocacy and shoring up that social contract with the American people is equally vital. So thank you for the opportunity today.
Well, and I want to thank both of you, Matt Olson, David Shedd, for making time today to talk about what is, as you both pointed out, is a vitally important issue for the nation's security. I think for those of you that are interested in this discussion and the topics we discussed, as David rightly pointed out, this is an issue that will continue with renewal of 702 authority coming up in the next year and a half. And then there'll be further discussion around 12333 and the surveillance that happens in relation to that. So I would encourage people to stay abreast of the debate, stay engaged, and also if you have friends or colleagues that might be interested in the discussion that took place today, this discussion has been recorded and it will become a podcast that will become available on the Federalist Society website, so look for that in the coming days. And so again, thanks to both of our speakers, and with that, Will, I'll turn it over to you to close us out.
All right. Thank you, Matthew. And thank you for both of our speakers and everyone who joined us today. We'll hope you'll join us on Monday at 2 p.m. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.